Paul Merton was just trying to sabotage us by chatting to us.
Yes.
You can't be doing that.
It's an old trick.
Yeah. welcome to the show, Paul Merton.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. I'm very pleased to be here and thank you for giving me this time.
It's nothing to do with us, to be honest. It's really time.
I'm very popular around here.
We're not really interviewers, you might have guessed.
Yes, I can tell. Do you want me to start talking?
You just start talking. What are the questions?
What's he going on about now? He's mentioned trumpets. I'll come back to the subject in hand. Do you know what I'm doing, David? I'm travelling around the country.
We know that.
We do know what you're doing. We do know what you're doing.
Paul Merton's Silent Clowns.
Indeed, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
What is that?
What I'm doing, I'm travelling around with a musician, Neil Brand, and we've taken around clips of Charlie Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy, plus a full-length Buster Keaton film called Seven Chances. And basically, we're showing these silent films as they normally would have been seen in the past, back in the 1920s, on a huge screen with live music and a big audience, and it transforms the experience of it, because if you know silent films from TV, you know it as one thing sometimes where the film's running too fast or it's got the wrong sort of music on it, always on a small screen. It's awful. You really can't judge it from that. And what's happening, I'm glad to say, we've got a 5-star review in the Yorkshire Post this morning, so we are really pleased with it.
Aww.
So we're travelling all over the place. We're going to Scotland, we're going to Inverness, we're going to Perth, we're going to Aberdeen, so we're going to all these places, and there's a real buzz about it, so it's very exciting.
And you'll introduce it and talk about it?
I'll introduce it. There's a film that we found that's made in 1911, a French film called Artem Swallows His Clarinet. Now, it's the most accurately named film you've ever seen in your life.
Did you do what it says on the
box? It's 4 minutes long, and you won't come away saying, well, I wanted him to swallow his clarinet more than he did. You will have said, I've seen something that will stay with me for the rest of my life. And it's great. It's a surreal film. As I say, it's only 4 minutes long, but it's a surreal film before the term surrealism was even coined. It's from 1911.
Wow.
And presumably also before there were special effects which would allow you to swallow.
Yes, well, he's got sort of half the clarinet in his mouth, and the second half is sticking out the top of his head. It's quite an arresting image when you first see it. The people of Birmingham last night, all 500 people, will never forget that moment. They needed counselling immediately afterwards, but then they were right for the second half.
Where did you find this?
The extraordinary thing these days, the world of the DVD, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you wanted to collect this stuff. It was all in archives all around the world. But now, because of DVD, it doesn't cost much to put this stuff on there. So actually, you go to one of the sort of popular websites and just look up early French silent film. People will send you DVDs full of the stuff. It's amazing.
Yeah. So, to be clear, does he not swallow his clarinet?
Yes, he does.
Because there wasn't there
is
a...
It like goes through his head, too. Basically.
Mr. Monge 2, who actually ate things.
He did. It's not like that, though.
Was that true? No. He did eat things?
Mr. Monge 2.
He eats a plane.
It was a French book. It used to be on Record Breakers when you were a kid.
He
ate stuff.
Yes,
he
ate
all sorts of things. He had these horrible teeth.
Yeah.
He obviously crunched it all down.
So he just ate it. Didn't he eat a
747 jet midair above Dallas?
and then they had
to crash land because he'd eaten one of the wings.
Something like that. Yeah. No, I think he actually ate a plane. I think that was his bit.
Bit by bit, bolt by bolt.
Yeah.
Yes.
This was in the days when that was entertainment, of course. I don't think you'd get away with that prime time now.
It's slow.
It is. It takes a long time.
You know. Yeah. You'd maybe sort of, you could expect sponsorship for a Volkswagen. Perhaps Volkswagen would sponsor one of their own cars being eaten. But I think... But for a plane, it's overdoing. It's over-egging the pudding.
What happened to him? He probably got indigestion and died.
I think he probably couldn't fly because he set off the metal detectors.
Well, yes. He did have funny teeth. I think they were metal or something.
Yeah.
And you've got to... Now, so what do you actually do? Well, if we turn up to see...
Do you do a Q&A after? Is it not Q&A?
No, I don't do that, no. But what we do is we start off by sort of, say, we show them a clip from a guy called Snub Pollard, who heavily influenced the Wallace and Gromit films in a small way, and he's an inventor. And some of the gags you can see are Wallace and Gromit gags, in a good way, you know, I'm not saying they stole them. So that gives people an immediate sort of, so this visual stuff is still around today, but we don't often think about it. But actually, there's always physical, visual humour around. You think of something like You've Been Framed, people falling over, Auntie Mary falling over on the polished wedding floor, she's too many sherries. You know, we laugh at people falling over in a basic form, and kids find adults falling over extremely funny.
Yeah.
Because it disturbs a normal pattern, doesn't it? Where the adults are telling them what to do and they're being the sensible ones, and suddenly they're falling over, hitting each other with bricks and things.
Yeah.
They think that's hilarious. They love it.
Yeah.
Have you always loved silent films? Is it something?
Yeah, from seeing it initially on television, but then going to a cinema here in London when I was about 13 and seeing the film called The General, a Buster Keaton film on a big screen.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, and I think it's the combination of the music and the picture together, the live music, which really sort of carries it off. I did want to say one thing. I mean, I've got a lot of dates here, but there's one thing I wanted to mention, the Hackney Empire 10th of May, because I'm hiring a... We've got a five-piece band that night. So instead of the pianist, we're going to have a drummer, a violinist, a guitarist, a pianist. It's, you know, and that is really something when you've got a five-piece band playing. And I think people just really get the sort of fact that these films are not just being shown for sort of like a nostalgic sort of, you know, isn't it quaint sort of thing. I'm showing them because I think the best of them still work in a very funny way, and they do, and that's great, you know.
So people genuinely are finding it funny.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's...
It'd be a miserable tour by now if they hadn't.
Well, there's not much
I can do.
No, I suppose. But it could exist just as something, you know, sort of a piece of history.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Yes, but it's the idea is it must be entertaining. It has to be entertaining. And also, the criteria as well is to find the best possible print that you can, because a lot of this stuff is very dark these days because, you know, it wasn't particularly well kept back in the 1920s or whatever. So when they see the quality of the picture and the quality of the music and just, you know, 500 people laughing at a visual stuff, unlike cinema, you know, with words, you don't... If you look away from the screen for a moment, the whole thing's gone. Mm. So it takes a certain amount of focus, like radio takes a certain amount of focus. And I think that's the focus that's being repaid when they come to see these films.
And who is coming to see it? Are you finding a cross-section? Are children coming?
Yeah, we could sort of... I sort of say with anybody over the age of 7, really. Sort of, if they're a bit younger than that, it might get a bit dull. But no, we had a couple of 4-year-olds the other day who just loved it. They loved every time a man falls over on screen, they thought this is the funniest thing they've ever seen.
And that happens a lot, doesn't it?
It does happen a lot.
Yeah.
You know? But there is a sort of... There's a real structure and there's a cleverness in these films, as I show with the Buster Keaton film, Seven Chances, which is a feature, which in those terms means it's only 50 minutes long, but it's a long film of its time. There's a proper storyline, there's a proper structure, there's brilliantly told gags, and story is told brilliantly visually. And it really is the sort of heart of cinema, the root of good cinema. Hitchcock always used to prefer to sort of... He used to be described just the standard two-shot of going to that person as photographs of people talking. Mm. Yes. And he liked to have the visuals. And if you think of all the visual moments in Hitchcock films that you enjoy, none of them have got any dialogue. No. There's the shower scene, there's the crop dusting scene in North by Northwest, and he tells the story through the visual, and at its purest, that's what cinema is, I suppose.
You did a documentary recently about Hitchcock.
Yes, I did, yes, And fascinating man, I loved him. He was and technicians loved working with him as well. He had an understanding of cameras and lenses which baffled people, how he could know exactly what was being shot.
I only saw the end of your documentary. I caught the end of it by chance, and I wish I'd seen the whole thing because I love about Hitchcock.
I think it'll be repeated at some point.
I hope so. Mm. But that seemed the end of Frenzy, where they come down the stairs.
Yes. Yes.
And the lengths they went to create... I mean, nowadays it would be done, you know, either through computer graphics
Exactly. He completely understood how an audience works. When he was growing up, he used to go to theatre all the time, West End theatre plays, you know, opening nights. He was avid, and he'd sit amongst the audience. And I think that's what gave him a real instinct of how you can play an audience. I mean, you understand as performers what I mean by that, a live audience. And he would sort of, like, in cinema, if you think about it, for example, that shot coming down Frenzy, all he's showing you is a camera slowly moving down some stairs. It shouldn't be as tense-making as it is, but because we've seen a horrible murder early on, he knows just a slowly moving camera, no flashy editing, or just slowly moving away from the door, it's absolutely chilling.
And
your tour is quite extensive, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We're going all over the place. Yeah, we're in Leicester tonight, the Mopford Hall.
So you're going up there tonight?
Yeah, I've just seen the dates.
Wow. Yeah.
There's a bunch.
Yeah, I mean, we've got about 500 people coming tonight in Leicester. I'm just sort of trying to get the extra guilt on the pudding, if you put guilt on the pudding. Do you put guilt on a pudding?
Well, Mr. Monge 2 would eat it.
Yes, Mr. Monge 2 would eat anything. What wouldn't Mr. Monge... Why is he called Mr. Monge 2?
Monge 2, eat everything.
Because it eats everything.
Oh, is that what it means?
Yeah.
I thought it was French for green bean or something.
It's this... Well,
but it's the green bean
that
you eat all of the green beans.
French is like another language, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
What's going on?
It's like Chinese.
I know. So we've got a couple of French films in here. So we are going all over the place, yeah. And what the joy of it is, actually, is that sort of... And I'm here just to sort of just see if I get a few more people in, because there's a real buzz about it, and it is great fun. And so much is down to Neil Brand, the pianist, because just, you know, you can appreciate the music, very important to the image, and if it's not, it completely ruins the film.
Is he improvising live every night?
He is, yes, and he's finding little gags in the film that he's now been able to make work just by what he does on the piano. So it's a constant interaction that goes on, you know. It's not like a film, once it's made and it's cut and it's done, then there it is. It's sort of, you can subtly bring out different elements on it according to what the music is doing.
Mm. When are you in London? Is that that's
we're done 10th of May, Hackney Empire. That's the one that's going to have the...
Okay, so that's after you've done all this.
Yeah, all those ones.
Does it cost more the night that's got a full band?
No. Not the people coming in. It doesn't cost them anything. Doesn't cost them any extra. Might cost me a
bit
more.
You're taking a pay cut.
So this is your thing. You're not just a hired hand here.
No. I've chosen the clips and everything, and worked out what films we should show, and I transferred them onto sort of digibeta tape so we get the best possible quality. So it's all about.
Are you a bit of a film geek?
No, luckily, and neither are the 500 people that came to Birmingham.
I don't mean listen. I do not see geek as a bad thing. As a lifelong geek of
many things. So where's your element of geekdom live? What is your geek land? What's in your geek land?
I'm a bit of a geek about. Well, I was a bit of a geek about Doctor Who before.
Were you?
I probably still am. And
well, see, there's a classic way of something reinventing itself. I mean, incredible. Who would have thought that sort of 60-70 years ago?
Geek for me is not a pejorative term. I mean that in a good way. Enthusiast might be the more euphemistic way of putting it. But
yes.
You're a film enthusiast.
Rather than slavish fanatic. Yeah, but film enthusiast.
You're slightly autistic about it.
No, exactly. Yeah.
So was the BBC 4 series your idea, or did they?
Yes, that again was something that,
just a lifelong thing. And
when I was 13 years old, and then, probably about 6 or 7 years ago, I thought I'd do something about it. And it's one of those things, if you're passionate about it, people can pick up on that passion. And if actually the films that you're showing are worthy of the passion that you're generating, then they come away thinking that was absolutely wonderful, which is what's been happening. So it's culturally extremely significant that that films from, 1911 are still being shown and are still working.
Yeah.
And with audience.
Is that a Buster Keaton film, where someone's he's standing in the building.
Yes, I can show that bit because the front of the front of that house comes off. It weighs 3.5 tons. The clearance around his shoulders is 2.5 inches on the shoulder and top of his head. The assistant director was so petrified of the whole idea, he retired to a nearby hotel and was praying with a Christian Scientist.
Wow.
While the shot was going on. And Buster wanted it to be as dangerous as it was because he wanted the top window to look like a real window. If it made it big enough for it would easily pass over him, then he thought people would see the gag.
He
didn't want them to see the gag. He wanted them to think it was going to hit him.
And he did all his... I mean, in those days, you actually did do all your own
there
stunts.
There was no health and safety
at all. Nowadays, go, I do all my own stunts and you're...
He seriously did. He used to say, well, a stuntman can't fall in a funny way. I can fall in a funny way, you know.
Yeah. Did he ever hurt himself?
Yeah, he broke his neck once. He saw several bones. In a film called Sherlock Jr., he was jumping on the long top of a moving train and grabbed the sort of huge water pipe that pushed him down to the track with some force. Got a terrible headache. 15 years later, he's having a medical for some film job, and he said, when did you break your neck? He said, I've never broken my neck. He said, well, we've got this growth here where there's this callus has grown. You must have done. And he thought, well, could it have been when I was running atop of the speeding train and I grabbed some water pipe and hurt him 30 feet to the ground?
That's got to be one of the contenders for it, isn't it?
And the doctor looked at the box and ticked the box that said, yes, I was travelling on top of a train at 30 miles an hour. So he was an extremely tough guy. And the thing that's him and Chaplin as well, they really lived for their films and lived and breathed them and really sort of put in tremendous work into making the best films they could. And that's why, with the best of these films, it still pays off today. The effort they put in still works with a live audience.
Do you think Keaton's the master? Do you think he's the...
Keaton, Chaplin, Stan Laurel, I mean, they're all brilliant.
Yeah, but who's the best, Paul?
Charlie Chaplin.
Is he?
He is really, in terms of sort of history. In terms of, like, when he started making films in 1914, there was a bunch of people in the park kicking each other, hitting each other in the head with bricks. In 7 years, he transformed the whole of film comedy into a thing where you could make a film called The Kid, an hour-long film that touched all kinds of emotions, sorrow, grief, great joy, great hilarity, and he was able to show that you can do all that without words, and that was his achievement. Mm. So it was like Shakespeare, or somebody just suddenly coming along out of the blue, it was completely different before he arrived, it was completely different when he left.
Right, right.
Made a big impact.
Is it physical comedy that you still find most funny?
Yeah, I think we all do, somebody falling over, and when's it coming up to the news? It looks like it's getting very close.
It's coming, he's helping us out, you see.
Oh, look.
Look at that.
Sweet.
We're so bad at it that the guests are telling us what happens next. but you're sticking around though, aren't you?
I am, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, I have to read this out now, I've got a bit of paper in front of me.
What have you got?
This is BBC Radio 2, online, on digital, and on 88 to 91 FM. Come on.
I never got that.